The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. We ended last week with Raphael Lemkin. He is the one who coined the word genocide in 1943. That's pretty late in the game, isn't it? I mean, just think, the word genocide was dreamed up or first used in 1943, just at the time that the United States, or under Roosevelt, was trying to figure out, was working on plans on how to criminalize all the Germans that they were currently engaged in a war with after they won the war. But to go on to review, Raphael Lemkin was a Russian Jew living in Poland. He was a practicing lawyer specializing in criminal law. He was arrested by the German police, as you recall, during the occupation after the 1939 invasion. He was charged with miscarriage of justice of citizens of German nationality. Last week I started then referring to them as German nationals, which was wrong because, of course, that's just my fast talking or not thinking, be having time to think it out, but they were Polish citizens of German nationality. That's a difference from them being German nationals. Now, why were they Polish citizens? Well, real quickly, after World War I, that eastern part of Germany was given to Poland. And so now all those Germans that were living there, they had been German citizens, now became Polish citizens. And it wasn't their choice. They didn't go in and choose to go and live in Poland, or, you know, take over Poland territory. They were just stuck there. And then they were persecuted against because they were German. Now, Lemkin had served some jail time over that charge of his persecuting the Germans. And it was less than a year. He served his time, and he was released. He wasn't sent to a gulag. He was, he just had his time to serve. Now, in 1941... though, he managed to enter the United States, and right away he joined the faculty of Duke University. Things like that are pretty amazing to me, but we'll see that this is just a real pattern that took place with these Jews. And here, this is interesting. He says he lost 49 relatives in the Holocaust. He survived, but the rest of his family died, so he says, or most of them, and he says, but some of them died in areas annexed by the Soviet Union. They're in the Soviet Union, but somehow they're part of the Holocaust, and the Germans are blamed for it. Now, in 1942, he was already lecturing at the School of Military Government in Virginia. I think that's very fast that he moved up the ladder, but we're going to see that that's quite typical of these European Jews that came here at this time, came to the United States at that time. And from these lectures, he wrote a book that was titled Axis Rule in Occupied Europe. It's a very well-known book. In 1943, he was appointed consultant to the U.S. Board of Economic Warfare and Foreign Economic Administration, and later he became a special advisor on foreign affairs to the War Department. You know, he is really in the big time here. So in just a couple of years, he rose up to that. In 1944, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace published his book, the one I just mentioned, which naturally included an extensive legal analysis of German rule in countries occupied by Germany during the course of World War II, along with this definition of the term genocide. So he is setting the basis for criminal charges against the Germans in the Hitler government. And this is what they wanted him to do. This is what they were paying him to do. And so genocide then became one of the legal bases of the Nuremberg trials. In 1945-1946, Lemkin became an advisor to Supreme Court Justice Robert H. Jackson for the Nuremberg trials. So he was there. And that is our first Jew after FDR, of course. I'm going to talk about 10 Jews that were involved in a big way at Nuremberg. And he is number one, even though we can call FDR the first one, because of his decision after 1942 on to prosecute the Germans as war criminals and his administration's interest in pushing this. After the war, just as a little interest, Lemkin lectured at Yale, and then he became a professor of law at Rutgers. He died at the age of 59 of a heart attack. And it was mentioned in the bio of him that only 7 people attended his funeral. And there was no explanation of that. It just said, now, usually if you're 59 years old, you're young, there's a lot of people at your funeral. The younger you are, the bigger the funeral you would have. But only 7 people. That's an interesting little comment about this man. So while he invented the term genocide, the term was entered into law by the naturalized American-Lithuanian Jew, Lieutenant Colonel Murray Cohen Bernays. As I mentioned before in past programs, Bernays was Murray Cohen. He married the sister of Edward Bernays, who is the called the father of public relations. He's the famous one. She was the niece of Sigmund Freud. But he took her name and made, I guess, Cohen his middle name, in order to be a part of the Bernays family. And he used Lemkin's book, Axis Rule in Occupied Europe, as the hook, as it's called, on which to hang the most extreme charges against the Nazis. So that's what those two have in common. The U.S. Office of Chief of Staff appointed Bernays to head up the investigation on Nazi war crimes against U.S. servicemen. And Bernays was a graduate of Harvard Law School, practicing in New York at the time of his appointment. Now, we're going to find that a lot of these people who were involved in Nuremberg were connected with Harvard and with Yale. Much more with Harvard, but also Yale. Bernays came up with the idea that it would not be good enough to try specific individuals for specific offenses. They weren't going to get enough of their money that way. So he thought that would be a travesty of justice, he said, to try individual Nazis and leave the Nazi movement out of which they emerged unpunished. So, as we know, he made the entire Nazi movement and everything that was associated with it under criminal indictment. So what he was doing was looking for a philosophical and theoretical rationale to hang the whole lot, in quotes. He wanted to get everybody. He didn't want anybody to get away. And he found inspiration in Lemkin's book. Lemkin argued that the organizations like the SS were criminal conspiracies. That's what you're going to find in his book. Things like that. Now, how he knew that there were 6 million Jews in 1943, I'm sure he didn't. But supposedly, there was the argument that came, maybe it came up later, that all this murder of all these millions could be viewed as a monstrous conspiracy against humanity. And it was a conspiracy based upon the doctrine of racial purity. And, you know, now here we have these Jews basing their writings and their big, deep thinkings about why this was such a monstrous conspiracy, because it's based on racial purity. Their race and their religion has been promoting racial purity from the beginning for thousands of years. So it's really an irony. Now, Roosevelt endorsed Bernays' ideas in November 1944. His administration officially endorsed it and said, this is the way that we want to go. So these two Jews alone were responsible for the legal framework of punishing the Germans. They came up with the most serious crimes they could dream up. And there were other Jews, and now these are my Jews 1 and 2, but there are others, Morgenthau, Bernard Baruch, Nahum Goldman, who I will mention in number later, and many, many others. All these other Jews came up with the idea that Germans must be harshly punished, and then Lemkin and Bernays came up with the legal framework, that is, how it could be done under the law, so to speak, or appear to be legal. So they created these laws, so to speak. The ADL tells us that altogether there were over 680 prosecutors at Nuremberg, and they say they're too numerous to name. Well, they are, and we will never know all their names, but that's the number that's given for just prosecutors. Of course, that's for all four countries. So I'm going to just talk about those who were working for the United States of America. Some of them spoke before the tribunal, and of those, we have the top ones who were the ones who could get up and speak. Number one is Chief of Counsel, which is Robert H. Jackson, called Mr. Justice Robert H. Jackson. He was Roosevelt's man, and Morgenthau's too, I suppose. He led the American delegation to London, and some interesting facts about him that show the nature of his mind is that, one, he argued in favor of prosecuting the Nazi leadership as a criminal conspiracy. He was all for that. He was behind the prosecution's decision to include membership in any of the six criminal organizations in the indictments, but the IMT rejected this on the grounds that it was wholly without precedent in either international law or in domestic laws of any of the allies. So here we have a justice of the Supreme Court, Robert Jackson, who is for things that are basically illegal and are legal in both international law and U.S. law, and yet he's saying, well, we should do this here at the IMT, and even the IMT as a whole rejected these things as being too far out of the legal framework that they were trying to pretend that they were in. Then the third thing, he attempted to have Alfred Krupp be tried in place of his father, Gustav. Now, Gustav Krupp was the head of the big Krupp industrial complex, and something happened to him. I don't know if he died right before the trial or if he got very ill or something, but he couldn't be tried. And so then this Jackson wants to try his son in his place, and his son wasn't responsible for what took place there. You know, it was the father that was in charge. And this was rejected by the IMT. So, to go on, the next level under Jackson was the Executive Trial Counsel. And there are two, Colonel Robert G. Story and Mr. Thomas J. Dodd. Neither of these are Jewish. Story was a Texan, practiced law in Dallas, and he was very friendly with Roosevelt. And Thomas Dodd, there's a lot of publicity about him. He's the one that was holding up the shrunken head in the famous photograph, the shrunken head that supposedly was found at Buchenwald. But he had Irish ancestry, and he's a graduate of Yale Law. He became an FBI agent. He worked in the Roosevelt administration. He prosecuted the Ku Klux Klan in the 30s, and he was at Nuremberg for 15 months, which was a long time. That's why he wrote a lot of letters to his wife. And in one of these letters, which his son, Senator Chris Dodd, revealed in a book in the last few years ago, he wrote it's famous now what he said, "I tell you that this staff is about 75% Jewish." Now, was he talking about the American staff? Probably, maybe the staff of the entire trial, but in any case, 75% Jewish, he says. Now, he said that he thought Jews should stay away from the trial for their own sake because it didn't look good. And he said the charge is going to be made later that this was done for the Jews, you know, and this is not a good idea. Then he writes, quote, "The too large percentage of Jewish men and women here will be cited as proof of this charge. Sometimes it seems that the Jews will never learn about these things. They seem intent on bringing new difficulties down on their heads. I do not like to write about this matter. It is distasteful to me, but I am disturbed about it. They are pushing and crowding and competing with each other and with everyone else." Now, this really was the atmosphere of that international military tribunal. Pushing, crowding, competing. It was like a free-for-all going on because law had sort of been abandoned, and you had a powerful conquering occupier and a totally broken and starving German population, and everybody could do whatever the heck they wanted. There was no law being applied against anybody except the Germans. Another thing about the number of people, the Hungarian journalist Louis Marcelko wrote in The World Conquerors, and many of you know this, but it's an important statement that he made, highly quoted. He certainly investigated this for his book. He said that out of 3,000 people employed on the staff at the Nuremberg courts, 2,400 were Jews. Now, that's four-fifths, ladies and gentlemen. 2,400 out of 3,000 were four-fifths of the people employed there at the staff were Jews, according to Marshelko. Going on to the next category, we have the Associate Trial Counsel, and that's four gentlemen, headed by Mr. Sidney S. Alderman, who was our Jew number three in this program. Also, Brigadier General Telford Taylor, who's very well known, and Colonel John Harlan Amon, who was a graduate of Harvard and a U.S. Army intelligence officer, and Ralph G. Albrecht, who served under Story and did a lot of work on the organization of the Nazi Party and the state. Now, I'm going to talk first about Telford Taylor, though he is not Jewish, but he's very important, and he's credited with designing the procedure for gathering evidence and organizing the preparation for the trial, although he had others working under him doing that, mostly Jews. Now, he graduated from Harvard Law School in 1932, and in fact, the year when Roosevelt was elected, and immediately went to work for the government, Roosevelt's government. He was part of the Roosevelt administration from the beginning. He joined Army Intelligence when they got into the war in 1942, and right away, he was leading the group that was responsible for intercepted German communications using ultra encryption. In 1943, he visited Bletchley Park in London, in England. That's the main decryption center there in England. And in 44, he was promoted to full colonel and assigned to Robert Jackson's team to work out the legal basis for the Nuremberg trials. And during the tribunal, he was Jackson's chief prosecutor, even though he was very young. He was not even 40 yet. Later, he seemed to be somewhat ashamed, they say, of what he had participated in, but he put the best face on it. Well, you know, he benefited from these kinds of connections he had all his life, and he probably was, being that he was not Jewish, he probably was a little ashamed, but he wasn't that ashamed to ever really tell the truth about it. So along with Taylor, though, comes someone who I don't have classified other than being working under Taylor, but his name is Richard Sonnenfeld, and he is Jew number four. He began as a U.S. Army interpreter and then rose to the position of interrogator, working directly with Taylor and Jackson. He was a Jew born in Berlin whose family went to the United States in 1940-41. And he was brought up there, and he's one of these many, many new U.S. citizens, Jews that came from Europe, who were chosen and picked out to help prosecute the post-war program of punishing Germans. Now, I'm sure they wanted to do it too. So it was a marriage made in heaven there. In 1945, when the war ended, this Sonnenfeld was only 22 years old, but yet he was present as an interrogator of the top National Socialists of Germany. And now the kind of person that he was is revealed in his autobiography called Witness to Nuremberg that he came out in 2006. And he wrote about his first interrogation of Hermann Göring. And Sonnenfeld said that when he began to interrogate him, he was so aware of, acutely aware of being a German refugee. That is, you know, he was acutely aware of the gripe that he had against this man and what he represented. Again, you know, he was only 22 years old. And he, so according to him, despite his nervousness, he said he sharply reprimanded Göring for interrupting when he was talking. And he said to him, "When I speak, you don't interrupt me. You wait until I'm finished, and then when you have to say something, I will listen to you and decide whether it's necessary to translate it." Well, he's giving us here that if he doesn't think something that Göring says needs to be in the record, then he won't, or translated to the others around that are there, he won't do it. You know, it's up to him. And then he says at one point, remembering a childhood joke, He addressed Goering as Herr Goering, which is spelled G-E-R-I-N-G, a play on the name that means little nothing in German. Now, this is, again, a 22-year-old able to insult this Reich Marshal of the German Air Force and great fighter ace of World War I. And this is the mood and tone of this tribunal everywhere. And of course, it was a lot worse with some of the others. And the Jews were lording it over the Germans in a way that the Germans never lorded it over the Jews, in spite of what is said in fictional accounts that masquerade as fact. They didn't behave that way. And strangely, also, there were never any preparations made by the Germans for how they would treat the Allied leaders after a German victory. And they certainly intended a German victory for a long time, most of the time. And yet they didn't intend to carry out any punishments, any special punishments, against any of the leaders of any of these countries. In fact, Hitler showed that he always preferred a benevolent attitude, as we can see how the occupation took place in France, and also in Holland, Belgium, and in Czechoslovakia. Nobody was punished. They tried to bring people into a common way of thinking as Europeans, is basically what they were trying to do. Now, number three, back to number three, Sidney Alderman, which I mentioned above, he was equal to Taylor. He was one who read a lot of the charging indictments when that part of the trial took place. Plus, a lot of responsibilities as a prosecutor. But he didn't do so much of the interrogation. But he read out in November 26, 29th, he read the charging indictments on aggressive war and war crimes. You know, it took 4 days. And then on December 3rd to 5th, he read the case on waging aggressive war against Czechoslovakia. Only that took 2 days, 3 days. And then on December 7th, he read the charges on Austria, and he began reading the case on aggressive war against the USSR, and continuing on the 10th, when he read the case on collaboration with Italy and Japan, and the case on aggressive war against the United States. Now, that's a laugh. Charging Germany with aggressive war against the United States. Well, it's hard to find any clear information on Alderman. He, like, sort of has it all hidden, or there's nothing there. But I did find this story about Ann Stover of North Dakota, and she was working for Alderman, and it's very interesting. Now, Ann Stover is just a typical American young woman. She was not too bright, but she's, you know, had a nice personality and nice and cheerful. She was a civil servant in D.C., a secretary, and she was assigned to work at Bletchley Park in London as a secretary for General Telford Taylor. Now, she says that in 1945 May, she was assigned to go with Robert Jackson to assist with the Nuremberg trials. And she moved to Nuremberg, and she said she recalled that Nuremberg was almost completely destroyed. Yes, for certain it was. She was assigned to work for Sidney Alderman then, and his duty, she says, according to her, was to prosecute the Nazis for invading Czechoslovakia before the war. I think that was his main task, along with all the overseeing a lot of it. And she says, I went to trials whenever something interesting was happening and did secretarial work the rest of the time. I listened mostly when they were interviewing Goering. I would go in whenever there was something interesting coming up. Otherwise, I would stay at my desk and type a lot of letters to my mother and father. See, I don't think any of these people had to work any too hard there, because she says later that she remembers some of the fun aspects. You know, whenever there was someone of importance, she says, Justice Jackson felt like he had to entertain the visiting VIPs, and he would ask the girls to dance with them. She laughed about this. There was plenty of entertainment to amuse the guests, she recalled, including fancy dinners, acrobatic performances, and other forms of entertainment, of amusement. And this is while the Germans were starving and dying in camps and so on that Eisenhower had put together. I mean, and this serious tribunal was taking place, but they all had plenty of fun there. And she also did quite a bit of sightseeing, and she tells about that. But I don't want to miss out saying that she says that she remembers seeing the Nazis defendants in the dock and thinking that some of them were mean-looking. Well, you know, if you'd been through what they had been for the past year, in captivity, under interrogation all the time, and facing death, you'd be a little mean-looking, too. But she didn't seem to understand, you know, what was going on. In fact, she says, when they showed the pictures of the atrocities, such as making lampshades out of people's skins, I didn't want to go in and see stuff like that. That's when she wrote letters to her parents. You know, she heard that there was films of atrocities, so, and then she heard about the lampshades, so she put that together and thought that the film showed the Nazis making lampshades out of people's skins. And people probably listened to her. How many people? And because she was there, she knew what she was talking about. Well, I have to take a break now, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll be right back in a few minutes.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Poland is marking a national tragedy, a year since the presidential plane crash in heavy fog in western Russia, killing everyone on board, including head of state Lech Kaczynski. At the time, the shared sense of shock saw Moscow and Warsaw experience a thaw in historically frosty relations. Commemoration events have been held in Russia and are still going in Poland. Let's cross live to our correspondents on the ground, Alexei Yurshevsky in Warsaw and Alice Hibbert near Smolensk. Alexei, to you first, the square in front of the presidential palace there in Warsaw, absolutely packed with people, a huge national outpouring of grief you witnessed there today.
Indeed, I was here at the very same spot a year ago at the presidential palace, in front of the presidential palace, and the scenes which I see today remind me of what happened 12 months ago. Endless crowds of people have been arriving here since early morning, and I would say that in the past several hours, the number of the people has dramatically increased. I would say maybe somewhere close to between 2,000 and 3,000 people are now in this very same spot, but we are expecting at least 100,000 people to take part in the commemoration ceremony across the city and to take part, in fact, in a commemoration march across the streets of Warsaw. Now, at exactly 8:41 a.m. local time, a minute of silence was observed because we understand that it was the time, the exact minute when the presidential plane went down in the Russian city of Smolensk a year ago. We know that civil that services and vigils are being held everywhere across the Polish capital in different churches, and even the central cathedral is having a very colorful vigil right now as we speak. I witnessed this service on the large LCD screen. It's about 100 meters from where I'm standing right now. Politicians are speaking to the crowd here, trying to find words to explain the loss which the country suffered a year ago. The crowd is now expecting a speech by the brother of the late president, Jarosław Kaczynski, who is due to arrive here any minute. And we just heard a loud applause from the crowd. That was due because relatives of those people who died in the plane crash a year ago arrived here to lay flowers and wreaths. That's what they've been doing, in fact, all throughout the day at different cemeteries across Warsaw, because most of the people who died in that plane crash were buried everywhere across the Polish capital. Indeed, this is all about emotions today. The Poles have been very emotional and very mindful of what happened a year ago. And in fact, the mourning period last year lasted for a week, and this is what we're expecting this time as well. The mourning will last until the next weekend, obviously. Will culminate in a large mourning ceremony in the city of Krakow. That's where the presidential couple was buried a year ago. Indeed, what is happening nowadays in Poland, some experts describe it as a disgrace, because some of the political...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Now, when I left off, I was talking about Sidney Alderman, And I just wanted to make one more remark about him. According to our friend Ann Stover, who is our friend, because I'm so glad that she wrote what she did and has informed us, you know, from her point of view of how things were there. And she said that after the American part of the trial was over, she and a few others joined U.S. Assistant Prosecutor Sidney Alderman on a trip to visit the president of Czechoslovakia. Remember, he was running the aggression against Czechoslovakia case. And this president of Czechoslovakia is the criminal Edvard Beneš, really a horrible man, but that's depending on which perspective you have. But she says, quote, "We went to the president's palace, and we had to wait in the waiting room because they thought that women took up too much of his time." She joked. You know, nothing bothered her. She was a very good-natured lady. But Alderman took them to along with him, but they couldn't see the president. He didn't want to see them. Women were a bother to him. So then another thing I want to insert here is that there is a Lieutenant Walter Rothschild, who is our Jew number 5, who was in the London branch of the OSS. Now, he's not an American Jew, but I thought I could include him because it's very interesting that we have a Rothschild. He's a real Rothschild. And he wrote in his one of his reports in 1943 about the need for new constitutional and legal settlements in Germany, that is to give the Germans a new constitution and laws decided by the Allies. And he also worked on how divided sovereignty between Allied and German authorities could operate. That's all I can say about him at the moment. Now we go on to our next classification of assistant trial counsel for the Americans. And there are two people I want to comment on, and they're both Jews. One is Bernard D. Meltzer, who is number 6, and he did a lot of things, but he conducted the pretrial interrogation of Hermann Göring. See, now there's a third Jew. I don't know if I've covered all three yet, but he's another one who they put on to Göring. See, Göring was presented only with Jews, young Jews, too, to come and interrogate him and act big. And he also interrogated Walter Funk, who was the president of the Reichsbank. And he worked on a presentation of the concentration camp case, which described he described the Nazis' methodical record-keeping at the death camps. So he is saying that the Nazis used methodical record-keeping, whereas others in the Holocaust industry say that, well, they didn't have any record keeping. And that's why there's no records of all these things that they claim. Now, number 7 is another one on this list of that I just mentioned, Robert M. Kempner. He is well known. Many of you may have heard his name. He has a bad reputation among people like us, but he was born in Freiburg, Germany, to Jewish parents, and he was a little older than some of the others. And while still in Germany, he became senior legal advisor to the police in Prussia. And, of course, being Jewish, he was an opponent of Nazism. He left in the 1930s for the United States with his family, I suppose. And he did, once in the United States, he did research on European dictatorships at the University of Pennsylvania, naturally. You know, all these people were hired immediately by universities and or the government. And he was a consultant to the Department of Justice and other government agencies. His familiarity with the German police methods was useful at Nuremberg, according to Telford Taylor, who was his superior. And this man, here's the other one, Kempner headed the prosecutorial unit that drew up the case against Hermann Göring. So here we have the other one. You know, he then got these other young Jews to interrogate Göring and try to humiliate him as much as possible. And he's also credited with finding in 1947 what became widely known as the Wannsee Protocol. Just think, that important document was found in 1947. He found it. It makes me wonder now even more whether it is at all real or if it's a fake. Apart from that, here's something that he once said, a quote from him. He says, "It was in accordance with the tradition of our legal history that the victors should be the executors of justice in the occupied country after the war." Now, what tradition is he talking about? The tradition of our legal history. Is this American tradition that this is the way they behave after a war? I don't know anything about that, but I'm not an expert on American history, so I will have to look into that with other people. Or was he talking about Jewish legal history? In any event, after 1952, and all of this was over, he returned to Germany or stayed in Germany, and he practiced law in Frankfurt. And in 1960, he served as an expert witness at the trial in Israel of Adolf Eichmann. So, you know, I mean, these people are on the circuit. You know, they're doing the whole thing. They're giving their services. And here's something more about him from David Irving. David Irving doesn't like Robert Kempner. And he said that Kempner made few friends at the main Nuremberg trial. I guess nobody liked him. He coerced witnesses like Friedrich Gauss, who testified on the authenticity of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, with threats of deportation to Russia. He also slipped a note to prosecutors cross-examining Field Marshal Erhard Milch when he was a witness for Goering, urging them to investigate Milch's Jewish parentage. And there's a lot I'd like to say about Milch, but I don't have time to insert it here. But Milch was basically really a good guy, not a traitor, in spite of the fact that he was, I think, half Jewish. And this Kempner also allowed the faking of movie and photographic evidence. Well, sure, we know that they did that, and he didn't mind it. Now, these are lawyers, you know, supposedly totally immersed in the law and representing the law, and they are the most biggest lawbreakers you can find. Now, Kempner also stole numbers of original documents, according to David Irving, from the archives, and he was almost certainly responsible for the attempt to conceal from posterity the 1942 Schlegelberger document in which Adolf Hitler ordered the postponement of the final solution of the Jewish problem, which, as we know, was deportation of the Jews, until after the war. Now, they didn't want that to show up at the trial. So it was not found until 30 years later in the Federal Archives. And Irving says it was first published in his book, Hitler's War, 1977. Maybe he found it. I can't go into that either right at the moment. But that's what we have to say about Kempner. Now, other Jews who were highly involved, one is Benjamin Ferenc. He's number 8. He was born in Transylvania in 1920 to Jews, and he came to the United States. Now, you know, Transylvania is where Elie Wiesel comes from. This is Romania, Hungary, depending on how the borders are changed, area there. And a lot of Germans lived there at one time. But he grew up then, you know, he was in New York City with his family, and he went to City College, which is kind of in New York, which is kind of probably very low tuition, or maybe almost free for residents. But from there, he got into Harvard Law School. You know, they all end up at Harvard Law School or Yale, and he graduated in 1943. So he was just there just in time for the U.S. Army to use him, and he was assigned to join the Army, and he was assigned to the War Crimes Branch, of course, in Patton's Third Army. And he is the one who was at the liberated concentration camps. We see him in pictures with Ike and Patton at Ohrdruf as they're getting a tour, looking at things after they've taken over that area. And there's Ferenc there. Now, he's young. He was 25 or 26 years old at Christmas in 1945, and he was discharged then and returned to New York, and immediately he was recruited for Telford Taylor's Nuremberg legal team, and Taylor appointed him chief prosecutor in the Eisengruppen case. This was his first case. He's just a young, inexperienced lawyer, but he's now his chief prosecutor. And you know, the Eisengruppen are the ones, they were the SS, that was all SS. So they are really after them, and I shudder to even think about what was going on there. And he was must have been very good at his job, because all 22 of the men on trial were convicted, and 14 of them received death sentences, but in the end, only 4 of these death sentences were carried out, and there's big stories there. But to go on about this Benjamin Ferencz and the kind of person he is, because he's still alive, he hasn't died. He's in his 90s. Now, there's a 2005 interview in the Washington Post, which you can Google looking up and Arnold Weiss, I suppose Nuremberg, or no, war crimes or something, in Washington Post 2006. You will find it. It's very long, like four pages, and this Weiss is a pretty awful character. But within this interview, they talked to Benjamin Ferencz, and he answered some questions. And here's what he said. He said, while it was perfectly legal under military law to hand over suspects for further questioning to DPs, that's displaced persons, he said, knowingly delivering suspects for execution was not, well, my goodness. You know, so he's telling us that it was legal under the military law there in Germany after the war to hand over any suspects that you might have. Who are these suspects? Of course, they're Nazis, ex-Nazis who are trying to maybe, you know, get away, or, you know, go back home, or, you know, avoid arrest. And you could hand them over to displaced persons. Who were they? They were the people that just came out of the concentration camps, and others from Eastern Europe who are now floating around in Germany and being treated with high regard. And you could turn them over to these people for questioning. And he says then, of course, the DPs were not interested in extracting information. So they weren't going to question them. They were going to kill them. But he says, of course, you couldn't knowingly do that. You couldn't knowingly hand them over for execution, but that's exactly what you were doing. And this man is a highly supposedly distinguished lawyer, talking like this about the law. And he excuses it by saying, someone who was not there could never really grasp how unreal the situation was. You're darn right it was unreal. But he says, I once saw DPs beat an SS man and then strap him to the steel gurney of a crematorium. They slid him in the oven, turned on the heat, and took him back out, beat him again, and put him back in until he was burnt alive. I did nothing to stop it. I suppose I could have brandished my weapon or shot in the air, but I was not inclined to do so. Does that make me an accomplice to murder? Now, this shows how the feeling about Germans under the Third Reich and who were working like, as if you were an SS person, how even today, how there is no consideration whatsoever for them as having the same rights as other people. They are all branded. They are all seen as something that you wouldn't even treat an animal. I mean, you wouldn't treat anything like that. But they did. They thought they could do that because they had convinced themselves that the SS had done that to them, which they never did. So, well, I can't. You know, I have to move on. But this really upsets me. And this is not all of it. He goes on to say. He's again excusing. He says, it's important to recall that military legal norms at the time permitted a host of flexibilities that wouldn't fly today. You know how I got witness statements, he says. I'd go into a village where, say, an American pilot had parachuted and been beaten to death and line everyone up against the wall. Now, before I go on, I'll say that American pilots were bombing, not only bombing, but strafing all these German villages and towns where if they saw anybody there, they would use their guns on their plane to shoot them. They'd fly low, and they were just shooting and killing people, and they were destroying their homes, destroying everything. And so once in a while, one of them got shot down, hopefully more than once in a while, they got shot down by the anti-aircraft flak on the ground. And when they came down, the people, the townspeople were there. The people would rush and they'd start beating on these pilots. They wanted to kill them. They wanted to hang them. And sometimes they killed them. And I can understand why, because they had been killing them in far larger numbers. But anyway, Ferencz goes on and says, and says that he would line, he would go in the village where this happened and line everyone up against the wall, then I'd say, anyone who lies will be shot on the spot, you know, to put the fear into them that they would know if they're lying. And then he says, it never occurred to me that statements taken under duress would be invalid. Now, here he's a lawyer. He's in charge of these big law cases and so on for the U.S. government. But he says things like this. It doesn't occur to him that duress makes things invalid. I mean, this is just what was going on. You had these young Jews over there doing whatever they wanted. They had good pay, good food, good everything, and they were just strutting around. And they could get away with murder, and they were murdering. They had been murdering, and it was still not illegal to do anything you wanted to do to a German. Nothing would happen to you. Very unlike the way the Germans treated the occupied people when they were occupying in a country. So, Ferenc, he ended up going into, he also was involved in reparations between Israel and West Germany. He stayed in Germany for a long time, working for the Israelis, doing all of that, and until that was all over. And then he went back to the States, and he became a law partner of Telford Taylor. So Taylor was in with all of these Jews, and so any excuses he might have wanted to make later, and I'm sure because he wasn't Jewish, he was a little ashamed of what he had done, but he wasn't ashamed enough not to do it. Now, this Ferenc also, he was awarded the Erasmus Prize in 2009, which is given to individuals who have made especially important contributions to culture, society, or social science in Europe, by a Dutch nonprofit organization founded by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. In 2009, it had an award of 150,000 euros, excuse me, you know, along with the high prestige that it gave. And this is how our world works, ladies and gentlemen. Not a way that helps us any. Now, another really important Jew that I cannot forget here at Nuremberg was Colonel David Mickey Marcus. They called him Mickey, but his name is David Marcus, but known as Mickey Marcus. Played a key role. He was a fervent Zionist from the beginning, and he became a number three man in making American policy in occupied Germany. As chief of the U.S. government's war crimes branch in 46 and 47, he selected almost all of the judges, prosecutors, and lawyers for the Nuremberg NMT trials, which were the 12 subsequent trials after the IMT. And later, after all this was over, he was always very connected with Israel, but he became a commander of Zionist Haganah in Palestine, and when they were fighting for their independence. Now, he was assigned to plan for the establishment of occupation governments after Axis-occupied territories were liberated. Now, he was at the Cairo. This man was everywhere. He was at the Cairo Conference in November 1943. He was at Dumbarton Oaks, where the United Nations was conceived at that time. He was at Tehran. He was at Yalta and at Potsdam. And he got the Distinguished Service Medal from the U.S. because he played a key role, it says in the citation, in the negotiation and drafting of the Italian surrender instrument, you know, the surrender papers, the instrument of unconditional surrender of Germany, and the international machinery to be used for the control of Germany after her total defeat. Now, it was General Lucius Clay that requested that this Marcus be assigned to his staff for the U.S. occupation forces in Germany. And Marcus was also executive for internal affairs of U.S. Group Control Council, then its acting chief of staff, and then, after that, he became U.S. Secretary General in occupied Berlin, and he was a top Zionist. Much of his time and energy was devoted to improving conditions for the vast numbers of displaced persons in Europe, meaning the Jews. He was looking out for the Jews, and it says that he was the head of the Pentagon's in 1946. Hildring called him back to the United States to head the Pentagon War Crimes Division. Well, that's when he was selected work with the war crimes trials. And it says that he was concerned to ensure the complete documentation of Nazi atrocities for future generations. He was doing the work of the Jews, absolutely. Now, there's another Jew, number 10, Nahum Goldman. He is very well known. He is he was the president of the World Jewish Congress forever and ever. And for a while, he was also president of the World Zionist Organization, both at the same time. And in his memoir, he was very much a friend of Roosevelt, too. He reported in his memoir that the Nuremberg Tribunal was a brainchild of the World Jewish Congress officials, and that only after persistent effort were World Jewish Congress officials able to persuade Allied leaders to accept the idea. Now, it's clear that the World Jewish Congress also played a role in the day-to-day proceedings at Nuremberg, but they were strutting around all over there. But they also made sure, while they were there, same with Marcus, and he was probably working with them, that to make sure that Germany's persecution of the Jews was a primary focus of the trials. And some commentary here that I think is correct. Just as the Jewish lobby descended on the Paris Peace Conference of 1919 to promote their agenda there, so too it descended upon Nuremberg for the same purpose. And there's also the fact that the U.S. recruited 10,000 German-speaking Jewish refugees and trained them at Fort Ritchie, Maryland, in psychological warfare. They entered Europe on D-Day with the Allied troops, these 10,000, and their job was to create demoralization within German ranks. Of course, these were all German speakers. After VE Day, they then became translators, interrogators, investigators, disinfo agents, clerks, lawyers, jailers, and war booty hunters. And they are called the Ritchie Boys, which you can all read about, and there's a documentary film about it. But they were all over Nuremberg, and they were there as interrogators and translators, along with Jewish others who were not the Ritchie Boys, but there was also their Jewish media technicians from Hollywood and New York City. So we can see that this was a mass hate fest going on in Nuremberg, and it's no wonder that Julius Streicher called it a Purim fest. It was, and it was filled with Jews. And the British, led by Churchill, had originally wanted to just shoot the leaders of the defeated Germans outright, which wasn't too cool either, but Churchill repeatedly urged that summary justice be visited upon the Nazi leaders, and the Russians, though, insisted on a trial. Well, that's probably true, but it's also true that the Robinson brothers of the Institute of Jewish Affairs of the World Jewish Congress first proposed the idea of the trials to the Americans, which really means to Roosevelt. And it was the YIVO, Y-I-V-O, Institute, the Jewish Scientific Institute in New York, which processed, altered, and forged captured German documents for the trial. So what does this tell us? This is a powerful group interest at work. This is what I want to leave you with, ladies and gentlemen, because this is where I started. You know, I said in my beginning of my first program, I want to get across an important concept. The concept is that some things just don't mix. Germans and Jews, for one thing. Just because Jews are said to have thrived in Germany doesn't mean it was good for the Germans. They, the Germans, don't thrive under Jews or with Jews. The same can be said for Aryans and Jews. So the disaster that we see taking place for our people should be enough to overcome the idea that we have to be nice and welcome everybody. Instead, we must bind together as a group. We need to think, group is good, we are necessary, we must take care of ourselves. Group interest is not wrong, group interest is necessary for us also. That's it for this program on Nuremberg and the Jews, and I thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Please come back with me next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.